Hello, this is Atah Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, April 7th, 2026, coming to you from my home studio. We start on the front page, Eastern Illinois University. Panthers find home on sand. New Beach Volleyball Facility hosts first home game. I think I'm going to start with a photo since it takes up a large part of the article here. Eastern Illinois University's Lily Ametis dives in the sand during the home match against Lindenwood at the New Beach Volleyball Facility at Linder Sports Complex in Charleston on Friday, April 3rd. And she's horizontal. Her left foot is dug into the sand. Her right foot is high up in the air at an angle. And she's her right hand is contacting the volleyball. She has on really cool sunglasses and her EIU blue and blue top and black shorts. And then looks like a teammate, number 23, is right behind her in the sand. Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review, photo credit. Rob Stroud, Charleston, has this article. When Lily Ametis of Forsyth joined Eastern Illinois University's beach volleyball program in 2023 as a freshman, this team was just 1 year old and was preparing for its first ever home game that spring. After playing three seasons on a temporary two-court site at Charleston's Sister City Park, Ametis and her fellow Panthers now have a permanent six-court facility that they can call home. This facility, at the city's adjacent Linder Sports Complex, hosted its home opener Friday as the Panthers faced the Lions from Lindenwood University, St. Charles, Missouri. This game was held on Senior Day when EIU saluted Ametis and five others who will soon conclude their volleyball careers there. "I'm a little jealous of the other ones who get to stay a little longer and use it," the human services major said with a laugh as she contemplated her younger teammates' future games at their home facility. Ametis and many of her teammates play both EIU beach and indoor volleyball at EIU. Ametis said she is proud her senior year has coincided with the opening of the new beach volleyball facility this spring and the new Gardella family volleyball court indoor facility at McAfee Gym in fall 2025. Previously, the indoor volleyball team had played in the Lance Complex's Groninger Arena, which is now exclusively focused on men's and women's basketball. The indoor volleyball facility resulted from EIU's partnership with alumnus Joe Gardella and his family, who own and operate Spyglass Properties, LLC. The outdoor facility resulted from EIU's partnership with the city and the Charleston Area Charitable Foundation. We are all just extremely grateful to the community members around us who have helped make this possible, Ametis said. We have our own facilities now. EIU Athletic Director Tom Michael said the city of Charleston has done a great job constructing the beach volleyball facility, including having a large volume of specialized sand hauled in to create a first-class playing surface. He said upcoming additions will include lights and a scoreboard. Michael said Friday's game, which EIU lost 4-1 to Lindenwood, was the only home match of 2026, but he anticipates more will be on the schedule for future seasons as visiting teams see the high-quality facility at the Linder Sports Complex and spread the word. "People will want to play at a nice facility," Michael said. EIU has reported that the Panthers' next matches will take place at the Austin P tournament starting Friday in Clarksville, Tennessee. City manager Steve Pamperin said they were glad to partner with EIU and the Charleston Area Charitable Foundation to create the beach volleyball facility. Grants from the foundation also helped fund the construction of the Linder Sports Complex, which opened in 2023 off of South Illinois 130. Pamperin, who helped coach girls volleyball at Charleston High School before retiring For this role, said the new facility also will be able to host beach volleyball games for EIU intramural sports and the Charleston Parks and Recreation Department. In addition, Pamperin noted there are a lot of junior volleyball club programs in the area that could potentially use the new facility for matches on the sand. We are hoping, with our central location, we will be able to bring in some of those teams, Pamperin said. And there's another photo here. The teammate mentioned in the first photo on the front page, Eastern Illinois University's Sylvia Hodge serves against Lindenwood at the new beach volleyball facility at Linder Sports Complex in Charleston on Friday, April 3rd. She has just tossed the ball with her left hand and her left hand palm totally up, fingers flat, ball just above her hand. She's looking straight at it with, again, really cool wraparound glasses, and her right hand showing her palm toward the camera, making like a five sign, ready to strike the ball. And her number 23 on her EIU jersey shown prominently and out of focus in the background, fans in the distance. Joseph Resser, Herald and Review, photo credit. Decatur Area Arts Council's Ann Lloyd Gallery, Life of Karen Scheiman, unveils Art of Spare Time. This article is by Donette Beckett, Decatur. And I'll, as I did with the previous article, start with the photo and the caption. The large collection of Karen Scheiman's unique artwork will be on display at the Decatur Area Arts Council in April. And the first item I'm drawn to is a sculpture of a bird. It looks like a crane or an aquatic bird in a carved wood. Really beautiful. Next to it is a smaller carved bird, actually 2, 3, 4, 5, of varying sizes, going from smallest to largest in varying colors. Really beautiful, posed and displayed on two stands against a wall. And then in the background, some artwork of, looks like some tropical scenes, walkways and buildings and palm trees. Donette Beckett, Herald and Review. So maybe we'll find out more about these pieces here in the article. Donette Beckett, Decatur. What do you do with your extra time? For the late Karen Scheiman, creating art filled her quiet time, no matter the medium. Now the world gets to see what she did when she wasn't working. Several pieces from her large body of work will be featured in the exhibit Spare Time, The Life and Work of Karen Scheiman, during the month of April at the Decatur Area Arts Council's Ann Lloyd Gallery. An opening reception will be from 5:30 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 10th. Scheiman made ornate and detailed work in various genres of art, earning her an exhibit of her own. However, she would never know the attention her work has received. Scheiman passed away in May 2022. Her son and Decatur resident Brian Blassingame took on the responsibility of showing her work as well as telling her life story. Her story touches on themes that may resonate broadly, how people use their time, what defines a productive life, and how meaningful work can unfold outside of recognition or traditional career paths, he said. The exhibit will include paintings in various mediums, sculptures using various materials, and woodcut prints. And she did her own frames, said Katie Dunscombe, program coordinator for the Decatur Area Arts Council. She did a little bit of everything. The DAAC directors found that pieces fascinating as well as the stories that came with them. Most people in their spare time, you will find them maybe sitting on the couch, not really taking action, Dunscombe said. A lot of her time was devoted to giving back and creating stuff for other people and making it about more than herself. Scheiman created more than 2,000 works of art during her lifetime without ever exhibiting or selling the pieces. But it covered the walls of her house, Blassingame said. It made for quite a logistical undertaking every time we moved. According to her son, she worked steadily over the decades in what she considered her spare time, he said. It was mostly her self-taught practice during her lifetime. Although she studied art at the University of Minnesota, Scheiman built her career in finance, rising to an executive role at Salomon Brothers and trading on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile exchange during a time when very few women held such positions, Blasingame said. Later in life, she and her husband helped build a coral reef habitat in Bonaire by hand, an underwater structure that remains active today and continues to support marine life. Scheimann would scuba dive more than 2,000 times. Diving and creating art were used as stress relievers while working a high-pressure job. Her creations and her scuba diving were both meditative acts, Blasingame said. What's amazing is how she used her time. Her son quoted Scheimann when he was discussing her career and her art. I was just too stupid to know I couldn't do something. Her other thought, too, was that she really believed that in order to be good at something, you have to be willing to be bad at it at first, Blasingame said. She just never limited herself to any one style. While researching the artwork, the DAAC staff found more paintings on the backs of canvas on the finished pieces. Her subject matter is so vast that everyone is going to find something that speaks to them, whether that would be beaches, flowers, the trees, the ducks, Dunscombe said. The original artwork is not for sale. However, sales of prints will be used to benefit various nonprofits, including the local Arts Council. Fine art paper prints of any artwork, including those in the exhibit, are available in a range of sizes and price points. Customers have until June 30th to purchase a paper print from the Karen Scheimann website, with 50% of the purchase donated to the Decatur Area Arts Council. Each canvas print is part of a one-of-one first edition canvas print. Only a single canvas will ever be produced for that artwork, and only at the original painting's dimensions, Blasingame said. There are hundreds of oil and acrylic paintings in my mother's body of work, and I release just one of these canvas editions per month, so at that pace, it will take more than 30 years to cycle through them. And there's another smaller color photo here. Katie Dunscombe, program coordinator for the Decatur Area Arts Council, arranges a papier-mâché sculpture created by the late Karen Scheimann. And it's very interesting. They're various figures, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, kind of in a light brown. They look like religious figures, maybe church figures and attendees, and being stacked up on a display case. Donette Beckett, Herald and Review. Sidebar, if you go, what, spare time, the life and work of Karen Scheimann exhibit. When? Opening reception will be from 5:30 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 10th. Exhibit, April 7th through 23. Where? Decatur Area Arts Council's Ann Lloyd Gallery, 125 North Water Street. On the web at decaturarts.org. Fuel prices. Drivers scream for help at pumps. Retailers point to tightening margins. This article's by, Hannah Fingerhut, Associated Press, Des Moines, Iowa. The near-daily changes in U.S. gas prices are dizzying for drivers who are left feeling frustrated and cash-strapped by the highest fuel costs since 2022. With the Iran war pushing up prices worldwide, the U.S. average for a gallon of gas reached $4.09 on Friday, according to AAA. Prices can change from one day to the next or from one nearby station to another, forcing drivers in the U.S. to game out the right moment to fill up or hunt for cheaper prices. Experts say differences in price aren't typically decided by an individual gas retailer, and most of them aren't pocketing the extra pennies when prices rise. The uncertainty at the pump is trickling down from a massive, volatile oil and gas market that's making it hard for gas stations to keep up. Lonnie McQuarter, director of operations at 36 Lynn Refuel Station in South Minneapolis, said his margins have gotten much tighter. About a mile off Interstate 35, the neighborhood convenience store posted $3.399 a gallon for regular gas on Wednesday, which is about 18 cents lower than the metro average, according to AAA. We price based on what we're able to buy fuel at and how well we can operate, McQuarter said. He declined to speculate about his competitors, saying they've got different economics. Wholesale fuel prices, which shift multiple times a day, are the main reason. McWhirter said he's charging more than a month ago. He's also facing higher credit card fees and rising costs to maintain pumps. In times like these, with consumers screaming for help, McWhirter said small operators like him act more on emotion than greed. "We're in our stores every day looking at customers in the eye," he said. "It really takes a toll when people are having to cut back on certain things in order to afford to live." What factors into gas prices? A lot of it is outside the gas retailer's control. Roughly half the price at the pump pays for the cost of crude oil, the main ingredient in gasoline, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. About 20% goes to refiners and who turn the crude into gas. Those costs have risen as crude oil prices jumped in response to the war and shipping disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz. Gas retailers are adjusting the price at the pump to account for the higher price they just paid for their next shipment of gasoline. Taxes, federal, state, and local, account for nearly 20% of the price, while about 10% is left for retailers who still have to pay for transportation, labor, and other expenses. Retailers' markup has averaged about 38 cents a gallon over the past 5 years, according to the convenience store trade group NACS, citing data from research from OPIS. After expenses, stations may keep roughly 15 cents per gallon, said Jeff Leonard, a vice president at NACS. "Some make more, some make less," Leonard said. Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy, compared it to a homeowner's role in setting their sale price. "If I was selling a house today, I'd be beholden to whatever the housing market is," DeHaan said. "That's the same for gas station owners. Whatever the price of oil and gasoline are, they are a price taker, not a maker." What or why might prices differ from one gas station to the next? Although the national average just passed $4 a gallon, the price that drivers pay varies widely by state, city, and station. Taxes alone can create large gaps. California gas taxes and fees totaled about 71 cents per gallon last year, compared with roughly 9 cents in Alaska. Distance from refineries, the type of retailer, how much volume the location goes through, and whether there are other fuel options nearby also play a role. Gas stations near competitors may choose to price gasoline competitively on large outdoor signs to attract drivers, hoping they'll come inside and buy higher margin items, said Neil Walters, a partner focused on energy at the global management consulting firm Kearney. "It's one of the only retail locations where you don't have to go into the store to find out what you're paying," Walters said. "Who benefits from rising prices? While U.S. retailers sell hundreds of millions of gallons of gas a day nationwide, they typically won't see large gains when prices rise. The margins shrink when prices go up because it's harder for them to pass along the increases as quickly as they themselves get them," DeHaan of GasBuddy said. "When oil prices start to fall, retailers may recover some of those losses, particularly if there's uncertainty about future supply costs. Prices can rocket up but tend to drift down like a falling feather," said Garrett Golding, Assistant Vice President for Energy Programs at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. "Higher gas prices can also hurt sales inside the gas stations if customers who are being squeezed at the pump spend less on other things. So it's not always the case that higher prices mean the service station owners are actually doing better," Golding said. "Most profits in the oil and gas supply chain are made upstream," he said, "by companies that extract and refine crude oil." Still, Golding said, they aren't necessarily celebrating. At some point, a significant spike in prices could start to hurt demand. Move on to page A3, local and nation, the courts. Case poised for judge swap. Nichols is accused of assaulting teen girl. It's articles by Tony Reed, Decatur. The judge overseeing a high-profile Decatur court case alleging The sexual assault of a teenage girl looks set to be changed again. The first swap out of a judge came when Macon County Circuit Court Judge Lindsay Shelton announced she was recusing herself in the case against Douglas R. Nichols, 57, in a legal filing published March 11th. A day later, the court record was updated to show that presiding Judge Thomas Griffith had assigned Judge Phoebe Bowers to take over. But now her tenure looks to be brief. On March 20th, Chicago-based attorney Michael Leonard, part of Nichols' defense team, filed a motion on his client's behalf to have Bowers pulled from the case. Here, Mr. Nichols makes the present motion for substitution with respect to Judge Bowers only on the ground that such judge is so prejudiced against him that he cannot receive a fair trial, the motion says. Illinois legal rules allow a defendant to file a motion for the replacement of a judge as long as it is filed within 10 days after a case is placed on the trial call of that particular judge. The request for a change of judge in the Nichols case met the time limit rule, and Leonard, in the motion, argues his client has an undeniable right to oust Bowers as the replacement for Shelton. Accordingly, the Illinois courts have interpreted this statute's plain language as giving defendant an absolute right to one substitution of judge based on nothing more than an uncontestable allegation of prejudice, Leonard said, quoting case law. Upon the filing of this motion, this court shall proceed no further in the cause, but shall transfer it to another judge not named in the motion. Legal precedent says the defense, which declined to comment for the story, does not have to prove any bias, and no evidence to support the claim is included with the motion. Judge Griffith is expected to issue a decision soon. Judge Shelton's removal of herself from the case follows the addition of Special Prosecutor Kate Kurtz to the prosecution team, headed by Macon County State's Attorney Diane Corey. Judge Shelton and Kurtz have a professional history of working together when they were both assistant Macon County State's attorneys. Complex history. The sex crimes charge against Nichols already have a long and complex history themselves. The defendant is accused of 4 counts of criminal sexual assault involving a victim between the ages of 13 and 17 and 8 counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse. Previous defense filings suggest the charges involve evidence dating back to 2007. While investigating this case, a team of Decatur Police Department detectives digging for that evidence on family computers used by Nichols and his wife, Kelly J. Nichols, came across multiple childhood pictures and a video featuring the couple's 2 daughters. Those images were prosecuted separately against husband and wife as cases of child sexual abuse. Both Douglas and Kelly Nichols, 54, were convicted after a bench trial before Judge Shelton in October of 2024. Douglas Nichols is now serving a 3-year sentence while his wife got 6 years. Her penalty was higher as she was convicted of shooting a pornographic video, a Class X felony with tougher sentencing. Now attention is turning back to the looming trial on the original sex offense charges against Douglas Nichols alone, charges which do not involve his daughters. And in yet another twist in this case, the defense wants the trial moved to another county. Defense attorney Leonard said publicity surrounding the child abuse images charges have already hopelessly poisoned the pool of potential jurors who would decide the guilt or innocence of Douglas Nichols. Mr. Nichols has been subjected to so much negative prejudicial pretrial publicity for such an extensive period of time that it makes it difficult, impossible in our view, to get a fair jury trial pool, Leonard had earlier told the Herald and Review. State's Attorney Corey has hit back, saying the defense argument about tainted jurors is premature, and the defense's citing of previous print, TV, and social media coverage is not enough by itself to automatically give rise to the presumption that an entire community has been prejudiced. A hearing on the defense motion to change the trial venue is scheduled to be heard April 17th, and so far, at least, it's listed to go ahead in Judge Bowers' courtroom. Tour set for hospital's new surgery suites, H&R staff, Decatur, HSHS St. Mary's Hospital, invites community members to an open house to celebrate its new Center for Advanced Surgery, featuring state-of-the-art surgical suites and sterile processing department. The free event will take place from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, April 11th, on the second floor of the hospital in the Surgery Family Lounge. Attendees can take guided tours of the new surgical suites, explore the latest technology and robotics, view educational displays about the future of healthcare in Decatur, and meet members of the clinical team. "This open house is an opportunity for our community to be part of our journey," said Tim Lehman, President and Chief Administrative Officer at St. Mary's. "We are proud to invest in spaces and technology that enhance patient safety and elevate the care we provide, and it's important to us, that we share that progress with the people we serve. Inviting the public to go behind the scenes helps build understanding, trust, and connection to the care happening here every day." The four 700-square-foot surgical suites and adjacent sterile processing department are part of the hospital's $90 million renovation project, with other spaces such as the renewed chapel and upgraded inpatient units opening throughout 2026. Northern Illinois, horse rescued from flooded creek, Zareen Syed, Chicago Tribune, Chicago. A horse stranded in an overflowing creek in Marengo was rescued by first responders on Saturday morning following overnight storms. Marengo Fire and Rescue District's officials said they were called for an animal water rescue in an area off the 22,900 block of Anthony Road in unincorporated McHenry County, where a horse was standing in a flooded waters about 600 feet from the nearest shore. Firefighters and sheriff's deputies found the horse surrounded by fast-moving streams in Coon Creek, which had overflowed after heavy rainfall in the northwest suburb. The horse was believed to have been swept away Friday night or early Saturday, rescue crews said. In a Facebook post Sunday morning, Marengo Fire and Rescue District said the horse was standing on a small peninsula with limited direct access, and the depth of the creek at approximately 15 feet made it increasingly difficult for rescue crews to bring the animal straight across. An initial team utilized a boat to reach the horse, while additional personnel and a veterinarian worked from shore and nearby access points to support the operation, the Marengo Fire and Rescue District said. The team of animal rescuers took Nikki Wessel, a veterinarian of Cutting Edge Equine Veterinary Services, across the creek using an inflatable Red Rescue boat. Once they reached the small peninsula where the horse had found footing, Wessel began providing care, administering medication, and taking measures to stabilize the horse, which was suffering from significant hypothermia from being in cold water for an extended amount of time. Rescue crews then secured the horse using a wide rubber rope to gently guide it to shore. After nearly two dozen responders, including swift water technicians, were called in to move the horse from the water's edge to the roadway so it could be loaded into a trailer and transported for continued veterinary care. It was late in the afternoon when the animal was ultimately transported from the scene to a local facility, the crews said. The horse belongs to an owner who lives two doors down from Coon Creek, a Marengo Fire and Rescue District spokesperson told the Tribune. The owner doesn't live on the farm property full-time, they said, but an area maintenance person alerted authorities about the distressed horse. "It was a challenging, time-sensitive rescue. We are pleased with the outcome," Marengo Fire Chief John Kimmel said Sunday. "Floodwaters can be unpredictable and dangerous for both people and animals. We appreciate the coordinated efforts of all personnel who assisted with bringing this incident to a successful conclusion." The horse remained under veterinary care Sunday afternoon and was eating meals and doing well, though not completely out of the woods health-wise, the fire district told the Tribune. And a very powerful photo here. Rescue crews assist a horse on Saturday morning, April 4th, 2026, after it became stranded in a creek in Marengo following overnight storms. And probably six people shown, and the animal is coming onto shore out of the creek. And just looks just wonderful, wonderful that they were able to rescue this. Photo provided by Marengo Fire and Rescue Districts. And with that, we come to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald interview for Tuesday, April 7th, 2026. We'll take a short break and return shortly.